break here with some David Cassidy music, and we'll be right back.
I go insane, I hold my pillow to my head and spring up in my bed, screaming out the words I dread. I think I love you. This morning I woke up with this feeling I didn't know how to deal with, and so I just decided to myself I'd hide it to myself.
David Cassidy was the first mass-marketed teen icon. No, really, just ask him. That's what he says, anyhow. But regardless, he was definitely pretty big stuff back in the 1970s as a star on the Partridge Family. In the 1990s, he became a Vegas star, revamping and rewriting FX at MGM Grand after its disastrous opening with Michael Crawford. To hear him tell it, he was the guy who made Vegas safe for folks like Celine Dion. No, really, just ask him. Or try to. As you're about to hear, Cassidy likes to talk a lot. And you may be able to count on two hands the number of questions Steve got in during this unusual interview. Another thing to count is how many websites Cassidy pimps. But if you put up with all of it, then you, like Steve, can enjoy a ride in which Cassidy claims he may be returning to Vegas in a new show, and much more. Cassidy performs at the Orleans on May 7th through the 8th. Take a listen.
David Cassidy, welcome to the strip. How are you today?
I'm very, very well. And yourself?
I'm good. And where are you?
I'm at home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Yeah. How did you end up living there?
Well, in 2001, after being in Las Vegas for 6 years and writing and producing shows and doing over 2,000 performances, also having created and executive produced a half-hour situation comedy for Fox that I was doing while I was at EFX. And also, I co-executive produced a movie for television with NBC. There was a point where I realized that working 10 shows a week, flying on my days off, I was missing a big part of my life. There was no balance. I was truly the workaholic people were telling me I was. And, you know, I had a great deal of creativity that was, you know, I wanted to do a lot of these different creative endeavors, and I wanted to also be a dad and be a proper family guy, that I was really cheating them and myself. So my son, I was working 50 weeks a year. I would use the 2 weeks to come down to South Florida, where my wife was born and raised in Miami Beach. And she, like Steve Wynn and a number of others, graduated from Beach High. So she had a real knowledge of it and was quite...
Your wife graduated from where?
Beach High. Beach High School.
Which is where Steve
Wynn
went?
Miami Beach, where Steve Wynn, an incredible school that more people that you meet in life that you go, oh my God. The manager for Siegfried and Roy.
Bernie
Eumann graduated a couple years before my wife did, but they all did. But it had so many interesting people. Part of the Clinton administration's, I'm not sure if it was his cabinet or someone who was very, very instrumental in the whole Clinton administration, graduated a couple of years before Sue, and she's known all of these people on and off, as she being a songwriter and an artist and having worked and lived in L.A., and there's a very interesting, if you were to go on and see the people who graduated from Beach High, it's kind of like what Hollywood High was like in the 50s and the 60s and early, mid-60s. It had so many influential individuals that I just became aware of it because of her.
Did your wife know these people? I mean, was she contemporary with? I mean, she would be...
No. She didn't. She knew Bernie Eumann, I think, from afterwards. They had run into each other, and Sue had written perhaps one of either his associates or clients or someone that he had managed, I think, and I'm speaking really because I don't know specifics about it, but they had talked, certainly when I moved there and redid the FX back in 96, mm-hmm. they connected, and both Siegfried and Roy were very gracious and came to the opening, and I had come, and I had met them right before they went in to do the show with Steve at the Mirage. I'm wondering if, in fact, because of Bernie Human's relationship with Steve Wynn, mm-hmm. if, in fact, that relationship began when they were both at Beach High. I think Steve and them graduated in the middle of the 60s at some point, or maybe even the early 60s. I don't know for sure.
Okay.
But I do know that it would be naive to think that there wasn't somehow a connection between Bernie and Steve Wynn. And that, you know, decades later, they would end up doing business together, and having them come to the Mirage from where I went and saw that show with my stepmother, Shirley Jones, and my brothers, Sean, Patrick, and Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Back when they were at, was it they at the Frontier or somewhere?
They were at the Frontier before.
Right.
That, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the show there, and they had made the deal to go over to the Mirage, and they were very, very excited about it. And that was the first time I had met them. And at that time, I had no inkling that I was going to come to Vegas and was going to work and produce and write and do all the things that I was able to do there. But back to your original question, how I ended up here is really that I found a phenomenal school for my son, and that I'd made a conscious decision to get out of and sell the trademark that I owned for the Rat Pack Is Back, and not to work 50 weeks a year, not to do 10 shows a week, and also work in television. And I had also created a record company and a publishing company, and recorded while I was doing all that, and did release a CD, and it was insane, you know. And we found a great house on the water, and we looked in, you know, many different areas down here for a couple of years, and finally decided that because we found an amazing school that he could really flourish in, because he's a very, very creative guy, and knew what he wanted to do. At that time, he believed very strongly he wanted to be an actor, and he worked in a couple of loop productions and had been around both Broadway and the theater and television with me. Also in Las Vegas, had been around a lot of the entertainment business and, you know, all the various stuff that Sue and I had done, working with the charity that she had created while she was there called KidsCharities.org. And in the end, I found this school, and the moment we walked onto the campus and met all of the individuals, it had a very strong theatrical, creative arts, musical. I mean, there was a chorus, there is a chorus director there that was one of five choruses chosen from all over North America to perform at Carnegie Hall in his junior year. So I went and saw my son perform at Carnegie Hall as a result of going there, and it prepared him for college. Anyway, we didn't put any pressure on him, but he wanted to be in thespians and also in forensics, and he was nationally ranked, and he won the whole state competition for sight reading music and singing as a singer. And what it is they gave him 30 seconds to look at a piece of music he had never seen or heard, have to look the piece over, and then in front of three state-appointed judges, have to sing it a cappella,
mm-hmm.
Which I could never do. I mean, I was never trained to do it, but they're, you know, there are just a handful of individuals I've met who could do that, let alone do it, stand up on a stage in front of judges and do it. And he's an exceptional talent. and I'm really proud of him, and I'm glad I made the choices I've made. So, but I knew that this was right for me to do, and had an awful lot of offers for me to go out and perform and do concerts again, which I hadn't sung my own material, because I'd written or had, you know, people I'd worked with co-write for EFX, and then for the Rat Pack Is Back, we used all those great, in fact, Quincy Jones, I had called him and asked him who, he was the conductor and arranger for the Basie band when Sinatra made his Sinatra at the Sands in 65. I asked him if I could have a couple of his original arrangements for 1 o'clock Jump and a couple of other things, and he was so gracious and so helpful, and I got to actually use some of his arrangements. But I hadn't sung, there were no David Cassidy or Partridge Family hits or any of my own music that people had grown up with. So I had an opportunity to go out and do, you know, 4 to 6 shows a month as opposed to 10 shows a week, and stay at home a lot and be a part of his development. And he's now 20 and is now a part of a remarkable band that...
I saw some of that. I saw there was some YouTube videos, and you had introduced him and his band, The Fates,
right,
at something that was going on at the MGM.
Well, they did... wife is an executive national vice president of... in a company called Arbonne International. It's A-R-B-O-N-N-E. And it's, he was invited because they had met him. I performed for their big convention. I performed there and they met Bo, and Bo kept in contact with one of the people there, and they did a little showcase up in Boston where they were performing, and they heard a demo that they had done, and they offered him an opportunity to go up and sing in the band, to sing like 3 songs, and they were very generous in doing that, and they didn't ask anything of me or of Sue, but gave him an opportunity to, you know, get up on the stage and for the first time in front of, other than playing in a basement at a fraternity, do a professional gig. And they were fantastic. And there is some video, which, you know, we don't own. But I hired an independent guy just to come in to shoot them backstage and to have people get a feel for them. And what has emerged, what's happened, they've been in the studio, they've just finished an EP. I heard the last mix, the final mix on something yesterday, and he's just an amazing young talent, and the band are all like prodigies. They're all at Berklee School of Music, and he's going next year. He's moved from being totally there and playing music and writing for fun, kind of like I did, when I was cast in the Partridge Family. I had worked as an actor, even though I played in garage bands in L.A. I moved back to New York and got an agent, got a Broadway show, and then did like 10 leads and guest shots on the on network television before I did the pilot for the Partridge Family. You know, I did Bonanza, Ironside, Mod Squad, all those, you know, shows that were on that were our episodic, you know, major television shows. So the only reason I had the opportunity to have my career do a major left-hand turn was that the role I was cast in as an actor in the Partridge Family, he was the lead guitar singer songwriter, and that's what I did. So I had to actually audition after the pilot was made, because Columbia Pictures Screen Gems had a record company, and they hired a record producer who was Wes Farrell, and he he wanted to know if I could really sing and play, and I had to bring my guitar in. You know, I'm 19 years old, and had to audition for him. So, as it turned out, you know, we did very well, and you know, it's just funny to think back upon it, how things, you know, at certain points in life, how you're there at the right moment in the right moment in time, and you know, you get a role like that, and I was able to, obviously, I learned so much going from playing, you know, in bad garage blues bands to, you know, I saw Hendrix 4 times, I saw Clapton and Cream, and I saw B.B. King at the Whiskey. John Densmore, who was the drummer for the Doors, his younger brother Jim and I were in junior high and high school, and I went up and saw the Doors at the Whiskey. And, you know, to be in L.A. at that time was an amazing time to be alive and be a teenager and to be into music. So I had an awful lot of exposure that, you know, it was, but it was very naive, and it was just, you know, playing rock and roll and stuff for fun, and never tried to pursue it as a career. I pursued my own as an actor, and he was on the same path, Bo was, and it's B-E-A-U, so if you didn't know that, it's not like Bo knows baseball, Bo knows basketball. So that's kind of the story, and now, 2 weeks ago, he came on. I introduced him in Atlantic City at Resorts, and they played 2 songs with the band, and they flew to London and at the legendary Hammersmith Apollo, which is now, I'm sorry, HMB Hammersmith. They came on, I introduced them on my birthday, and they just blew the place apart. They are amazing players. They are literally prodigies.
And all right. Let me ask some questions.
Go ahead. Am I going too fast for you?
No, it's fine.
Man, you waited long enough for it, so I thought I would give you as much as I could give you.
I'm just listening to you
and
talk.
Going,
I'm realizing that
you're looking at
God,
your friend
using
your questions. Hands like mouth.
Well, no, it's fine. Well, let me ask you something. First of all, you talked about your experience with EFX, and I think it's really interesting that Vegas. I'm interested in Vegas at that period, because when you came to Las Vegas in 96 to rework the EFX show, which had been opened by Michael Crawford and
He was gone. It was dying a death. It was a very poor show at the time.
And whose fault was that?
I can't blame anyone. Again, I wasn't there. I only know what I saw, and it was a train wreck, I thought. Musically, it was all wrong. The whole story was just—I don't know.
I remember seeing it with Michael Crawford, and remember thinking that it didn't make any sense.
I will give you as honest an answer about any of this, because it's highly sensitive material. Because there are individuals that will be offended, but I will be as honest and open as I possibly can. This is not, I have no agenda, because I walked into a situation that was, I can't even describe the environment, but apparently the stories I heard were that it was a very unpleasant and ugly environment with a cast and crew that Michael Crawford himself had fired a number of people because he didn't like the way they looked at him or something to that effect. I don't know any of this because I wasn't there, but I heard some horror stories.
Did you interact with him at all?
With whom?
Michael Crawford.
No, he was gone. He was suing MGM at that point.
Okay.
And
Here's something I want to know.
I don't know what happened. I have no idea what happened, if they settled or what. I assume that's what happened. But there was, it was very antagonistic, and they were very gun-shy because apparently there were suggestions that he had abused the power that they had made a deal with him that was gave him all power, and they wanted nothing to do with that kind of situation with me. And I walked in wide-eyed and innocent going, oh, this is going to be fantastic because I think I know how to fix this. Because mm-hmm. the hardware and the effects were magnificent. It's just the whole thing didn't make any sense. So the whole thing had to be scrapped except for the hardware. Here's your job. You have to create four different events with four different scenarios that one is Houdini. You know, we could go on and on. I could get specific about it. But how do you tie all that together and have it make any sense? And make it entertaining, make it make sense, and make it fit you like a suit as opposed to something I didn't understand. Like you, as you said, it didn't make any sense. But I had people say to me, "You're gonna. Why would you do this? It's suicide for you to do this." And I thought, no. When something is as gone as wrong and as bad as that went, you can only come out making it better. And I think I can make it way better because what was good about it, the effects of it, the room and everything else, and they were all in at that point for $70 million. The problem I had is that I walked into a situation that they'd had so much adversity that the cast and the crew were like, uh-oh, we got another guy. And I just opened my heart and my arms to them and just went, hey, look, let's fix this. We can do it. And I didn't ask anyone to call me Mr. Cassidy. I didn't ask anybody. I don't know whether that was the situation, but I heard from people that it was very unpleasant, the whole backstage and off the stage when the show wasn't going on. It was not a friendly, warm, creative environment where you work together. There was a line drawn in the sand saying, you are there and this is me. And I don't work like that. If you want to work well as a musician, a writer, a director, a producer, you got to get the best people and encourage them to do the best possible work they can. So fire away.
One of the things about that show, first of all, just to kind of remind people what it was sort of, I mean, other than Siegfried and Roy, it was sort of one of the first big stuff. Well, I guess Mystère was out by then. But
this was the most expensive show ever done.
Right.
It was the biggest show. Because Mystère, although it was fantastic, and I went to see it like the second night I was in Las Vegas, staying at the MGM Hotel, putting together a plan to how to creatively fix it. The show was apparently what I was told was they were into it for $70 million when they opened, and they had had a number of mishaps because it was so intricate for the technology at the time and
This
the hardware.
This is in the same showroom where Ka is now, which is also an amazingly ambitious production.
Yes. Well, to fill that room of 1,750 people, you can't do a little show in there. It was built and created for EFX, and all I can say is when I walked in the first night to see it, I was kind of horrified that it made no sense. They invested all this time. I learned they were in rehearsal for a year and a half. Now, it took days to make any change in it, and because of computerized hardware, that if you wanted to make any change in the show, it took was a massive overhaul. And to try and get 70 people who worked backstage, and originally when it was done, there were 70 people in the cast on stage. That's 140 people trying to work together for the same thing. So to change anything, a lighting change or anything, took hours and oftentimes days, which is why it took them a year and a half to rehearse before they did a performance. They gave me 3 weeks to redo the whole thing, rewrite it, costumes, music, arrangements, recording, and apparently, oh, I know, he used a, Michael Crawford used, he didn't sing anything live. And that in itself makes things very sterile. There was no interaction, including the dialogue, which I couldn't believe. And he used a teleprompter on the first table in the center of the stage for the dialogue. So you're lip syncing to dialogue as well as the music. So all of it was like, nah, it's wrong. That's wrong. And the music sounded like kind of a Disney knockoff at Disney World, one of those happy, sweet little. I thought, no, it needs to be completely rewritten. And 3 weeks isn't a lot of time when you're dealing with that kind of show. So we did our first. I couldn't do it all in one, but it was towards the end of the year when it's traditional that they would go dark for 2 weeks. So instead of being dark, we had to work and rework. We made the big changes, and then we made some more big changes, and then eventually it took about, it took about 3 months to get the whole thing right. And within 3 months, it was a whole different world from a creative and from an audience standpoint and from an environment that was so negative and I don't know, adversarial.
Well, let me ask you something. Vegas in that era, it was still a place where, at least when it came to singers and performers, this was sort of where you went when you were washed
up. Dead zone. I called it Forrest Lawn's waiting room. And I changed the whole perception of that, I think. I certainly had a contribution to that.
Well, I would think that even Michael Crawford, you know, regardless of how the show went, the fact that somebody
would be willing to come
and do a show like that.
Right.
I wonder, I mean, what was happening at that point? I mean,
well, they were blowing up the old Vegas.
Sure.
While I was there in rehearsal, I can remember, one or two of the properties went up. And then I remember during the first year, by the end of 1997, I just looked over and I have the best of Las Vegas here. Best singer, best all-around performer, and we won best show. So it went from being the worst disaster. Within 6 months, it was sold out 10 shows a week, from 5 shows a week, doing 200 tickets a night.
But were you...
10 shows doing 1,750 tickets a night. And it was a turnaround that, you know, when you have that kind of success, it's startling the attitude of everyone around you. And I didn't realize it being as naive as I was... that so many people were on pins and needles that the head of entertainment was very frightened that I had done such a complete, you know, taking out everything that was done that I felt was wrong. I brought in Don Rio, who he and I wrote and produced The Rat Pack Is Back, and my brother. I mean, I brought in some great people to work with. To rewrite, we got a fresh choreographer, and
so I guess my question is: did you have any concerns at that point in your career about?
Yeah, no, I didn't have any
Vegas,
concerns.
Given the reputation of what Vegas
was. I know exactly what you're saying, and the answer is no, because I knew there was no way for me to lose. I know how to do this. I know how to fix this. I just need the time and the tools to do it, because what was great about it could be great. And what, you know, you can't put any more explosions on the stage. It's overkill, and the audience just backs up in their seat. What you want to do is engage them and bring them in. And that's done with self-facing humor. It's done by making fun of me, trying to, you know, I played a waiter who spilled drinks on a table. And the first opening moments of the show, and the waiter goes on this trip, and he gets to experience all of this, having to utilize those four different major hardware themes you know, and, you know, it was difficult to sell it to people who had who were responsible for presenting it to the COO, and he was very supportive, and I think he's a tremendous businessman, and he was willing to go, but I did something that apparently nobody in their right mind would do when I came in and presented the idea. The president of the hotel, the CFO, the COO, Alex Yeminijian, Terry, all of them were there who, you know, I didn't realize that they could have fired me that moment and said, forget it, this isn't going to work. But because I had presented something so different to them, but I knew it would work. And the one thing I asked before the meeting began in the, you know, the hallowed executive roundtable, I walked in there. It was very clear to me that I didn't think anybody believed in it, and nobody wanted to say anything. But I asked every one of them in the room, honestly, before it began, do you like the show now? Did you like it? Did you like it? And all of them said, no. I said, then why would you want me to just go in and do it because I can sell tickets? I can't sell tickets if it's bad. And its reputation, I believe you all know, is it's dreadful. Let's fix it and make it great. And I guess what I was told later was that was potentially career suicide. You know, you get hired and fired in a week. Anyway, Alex and Terry, to their credit, said, okay, you got 3 weeks. 3 weeks, okay? I need you to fly these guys in and put them up and we'll go day by day, and we'll start with this change and this change and this change. I need to get back in the recording studio and get some new tracks because they wouldn't hire live musicians. So I would sing and we would sing live to the tracks, which they didn't do before. But it was really everybody coming out, and once the king says, I didn't like it, no, I don't like it, then everybody takes a deep sigh, and, you know, to Alex Yeminijian's credit and to Terry's credit, I have to say, to Terry Lanny's credit, they supported me. And there were people who were not terribly supportive of that idea because it was going to, A, they had to shut the production down, even though it wasn't making money. It's an empty room, an empty space, and there's no entertainment for the high rollers, which it was getting a lot of at the time.
Now, remind me something. When mm-hmm. One time I went to see the show, I swear that I saw your brother instead of you.
Yes, you did. I left the show for 2 weeks a year,
uh-huh.
and I convinced them to hire my brother, who was great.
Yeah, no offense, but, you know, when I was a kid, I went on a trip with my family. We were going to see a tennis match, right? And the tennis tournament had, like, advertised that McEnroe was going to be there, right? So we were real excited that we're going to see John.
And his brother showed up.
And it turned out it was Patrick McEnroe instead. And it was the same thing.
Right.
I'm going to see David Cassidy. Wait, I'm not going to see David Cassidy.
Well, you know, I'm really sorry you didn't see what I did. And if you saw the show before, you saw the changes that
were
done.
Sure, it was a better show.
Way better show. And, yeah, I got Little Feet. I called my friends. I called Little Feet and asked them if they'd come and do a track I'd just written. And instead of this Disney thing, I did this, you know, Little Feet are just amazing. They're just killer groove. And, you know, I just knew there was a much hipper, smarter, funnier way of engaging the whole room, which is very difficult to engage a room of that size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it just worked, and it was fantastic. And I would have gone on and stayed on for another year, but I had, because it was really dangerous, that show, I had fallen through. Thank God someone had caught me. I'd fallen through one of the traps one night, and oddly enough, the president of the MGM at the time, the president of the hotel, was there. He saw it. He came backstage and went, oh, my God. I mean, the whole audience just, and as I'm falling through with my elbows out, trying to hold my body up, going, help, help, and the guy was underneath, I would have fallen five stories.
That's a lot like what they've been going through with Spider-Man in New York.
Exactly. And because there are, at least there are unions in New York. In fact, unions are making it very difficult to go to New York. I know because I'm right now developing a show that the original writer wanted to take, and they were really seriously thinking about taking the show and doing it for a month, 6 weeks, somewhere else, and then taking it to Broadway. And I said, you know, it could be the kiss of death. This is perfect for Las Vegas. And I know there are two rooms in Vegas at this show. So this has happened in the last month.
What is that show?
Oh, I can't tell you about it. I can only tell you that I don't need the money. I got the money. People have wanted me to go back. I have a lot of people that, you know, in knowing I would star in it and knowing what the project is, I've talked to the investors, of which there are two or three, that said, if you get the right room, we're there.
Let me just make sure I understand. There is some sort of a musical that you were looking at doing in New York, and now you're looking at doing.
No, they were. I convinced them that going to New York with it, it's really made for Las Vegas, and it's so, the concept is so big and it is so smart. It's satirical, it's musical, and it's also, it's the best thing I've read in, I don't know, 10 years, maybe more. It's the first thing I got excited about doing since I left. And I don't need the money. I just need the right room and the proper duty to commit, you know, to the wrap of PR, you know. I mean, really just of the marketing of the show in the right room and the right property. What producers don't realize and what most of the public don't realize is when you have a show that goes into a room, there are only a certain amount of A properties, locations. I know this because I've been in the A's and went to a B, and then you can't survive. Even with a show that's established itself, like, you know, the Repack is Back did at the Desert Inn, it was the perfect property for that show. And when you're putting something experiential, that when they walk in the room, they're in a different world, kind of, you know, without, they forget all of what's going on, and they're entertained, they're engaged, and, you know, it's I know how to do this, but, you know, I don't know how to do it, even though they do it incredibly well, like the Cirque people. I could never do anything that big and that, I mean, I have no idea how they do that, and they do it brilliantly. But there are now, what, 6, 7 Cirque shows there?
7.
And they don't leave. They stay there for years.
Yeah.
So those rooms are no longer available. And most of them are on the big A properties, or if not all of them. So there's only a select number of properties that, Mysterio's been there, what, 17 years, 18 years?
Yeah.
I mean, think about all of those shows that have been there for years and years and years. They can, it can be 20 years before one room opens up to take a new show or to put something else in there. And having to explain that to people is very difficult.
So what showrooms are open right now? I'm trying to think of what...
None that I'm... Well, there is one that's open right now, but it's not ready for me to go in, but it will be very shortly, and I'm going to make a presentation of it. And they workshopped it once, and then they did it.
Is this at the Tropicana? You mentioned you have a history with Alice.
Yeah, but there are other considerations to make. Unless you have something specific that's ready to really to show someone, and you don't want to go in and shoot with a cap gun. You want to go in and know that you have all of the elements in place. So without doing the show and spending $500,000. To do a showcase, or $250,000 to do a showcase for a couple of nights and weeks of rehearsal, what you do is you create, you know, through now what's available in terms of technology and in terms of props, in terms of story, script, music. You do a presentation like that, and it'll be ready to go, but it's brilliant. And I didn't create it and write it, so I can tell you that. And,
Who did?
I can't mention any of this until I get there, and I'm not being coy.
Sure you are.
No, I'm not. I just made a promise to them, and I would never...
Let me change the subject for a minute, because there's some other things I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
When you were in your prime in the 70s, when you were the big pinup...
When I was in my early prime.
Early prime.
I think I'm still in my prime, by the way. I feel that way creative. I'm better than I was then. And every aspect.
Well, my question is, you know, I was talking to Donny Osmond recently, and we were talking about sort of, you know, what sort of advice he might offer to somebody like Justin Bieber, who is in a similar situation.
Donny and I get asked that question. A few years ago, it was Zach, and then a few years before, it was someone else, you know, but...
Well, I guess my question is, when you were that age...
I was in high school. I was going to see shows when... He's 16, 17 years old, right?
Right.
I became a professional after I graduated when I was 18. I moved back to New York, took a job in a mailroom, and studied, and then got an agent, went on to auditions, and, you know, I knew what I wanted to do and was undeterred by anything, and, you know, I went to probably 150, 200 auditions before I got hired.
Well, but my question is, when you're that big and everybody is sort of at your feet...
Oh, God. Yeah.
Do you remember doing anything or misbehaving in any way that you regret?
Not something consciously, no. I mean, a lot of people were blown away by the fact I was on the cover of Rolling Stone because I had, you know, the television image, and I was like the first person that was globally marketed and merchandised. David Cassidy loved beads and pillowcases, and there was actually David Cassidy dresses, you know, lunchboxes, bubblegum cards, comic books, magazines, everything, books. So I was working, like I told you, the workaholic, 7 days a week, doing four concerts on weekends, doing a television show from 7:30 in the morning until 7:10 at night.
But were you always a perfect angel? You know, Donnie made the point that...
I think he probably was.
Actually, he said that looking back on it, he kind of got to be a bit of a jerk for a while there, and I wondered if that was the same thing with you.
I don't know that I was ever... See, I never believed... my father gave me a great education on... he treated, as I would like to believe I always did, he treated the head of Universal and NBC the same way he treated the guys that were elevator operators. And in those days, they actually had elevator operators. And he began at 16 years old being an elevator operator and then driving a limousine. And he was probably the most respected theatrical actor of his generation of time in New York. And I'd won Tony Awards, and he, every time he stayed at a hotel, he went down and did something I've never heard about anybody doing, tipping the operators that answered the phones. He tipped the busboys. He tipped not just the waiters, but the doormen and the limo drivers. He would take them out to dinner. I mean, here I am, 21 years old, 20 years old, coming to New York. I play Madison Square Garden, and the driver says to me, "Your father's the greatest guy I ever saw in the world, man. He took me to dinner. He tipped me $100. I'm like, oh, no. I carried $6 with me, you know. I'm like, oh, God. I keep paling in comparison. But he taught me that really, I mean, it was not a conscious teaching. It was really by being around someone who treated everyone with great respect and with... people who were hardworking, you know, his father, his brother, my cousin, my uncles, my niece and nephews, all were, including my great-grandfather who came over on the boat from Ireland, were hardworking blue-collar. They became engineers for the Long Island Railroad, and it's still going on now.
Well, you know, one thing that happened that I imagine probably brought you right down to earth in a way that probably a few other artists had experienced was that in 1974, there was actually a riot at one of your events.
And, oh, yeah, there were riots at all.
And a 14-year-old girl died. And
yeah, but it wasn't because of the riot. She was in the stands. That's what a lot of the media went and do what they do to make it sensationalize it. She had a severe heart condition. She got so excited. She was in the stands. She wasn't crushed. She was not part of the riots that were going on and all the kids that were treated by the nurses and everything else. But it was such an event.
Do you still have any time?
But I had announced to the world press that I was, that was it for me. My last world tour. I'm playing, you know, in America, I played the Houston Astrodome and I played the Melbourne Cricket Grounds and still hold the record I was told last year.
Do you still have any contact with that family?
No, but I actually called them after, and I didn't want to turn it into a media circus in respect to her and her parents. I called them the morning of the funeral and said, I mean, they were wonderful. I said, I'm so sorry that it happened. They said, you know, she really, her dying wish would have been to see you. And I said, I would come to the funeral, but I know what would happen. I think you probably would regret it. And by the end of our conversation, about 15 minutes, they were crying. I was crying, and I was like, oh, God. And he said to me, you've got the biggest heart, bigger than any place, I forget what he said, like bigger than North America, bigger than America. And I was so touched by that, that they weren't resentful, they weren't angry. I'm sure they've passed away now. I have not had a contact with them. And, you know, it just becomes, you're part of the media in your own way here, becomes something we can talk about and sensationalize. And it's a very emotional, it was for me, because the idea that someone had died at my show, but she wasn't crushed. She wasn't part of any drama that was outside of her own physical state. She got so excited that she passed out, had a heart attack, and died. And that's the simple truth of it. And they knew it. And that's the most important thing to me. And I didn't want to, you know, a lot of people say, oh, he's retiring because of that. No, I had announced this was it for me. I'd worked 5 straight years, you know, and, you know, by the end of it, I had the biggest fan club in history. It was fantastic. But, you know, again, like I made the decision back in 2001, I need to be a human being again. I'm just...
Well, let me, before I let you go, I want to ask you one more thing.
One more thing.
You were just on The Celebrity Apprentice.
Right.
You were the first one fired.
Right, I was, and I was thrilled about it.
And there are two questions in here. First of all, Donald Trump is now running his mouth about running for president.
No, he's not.
And saying a lot of stuff.
No, he's not.
Well, he is running his mouth. He certainly
I don't believe that.
You don't believe
that's
what?
That's the answer. I don't believe that.
You don't believe he's running for president?
No, I don't.
Okay. Is there anything that he's said that
no, I
you?
Just know I've met him in the past, and no, I don't believe so. I don't believe that anyone, the scrutiny that he would have to go through, what's in his closet, as in just about everybody's, unless you're, you know, I was about to say unless you're a priest, but that doesn't work anymore either. No, the scrutiny is just too great. And, you know, being a businessman who's declared bankruptcy and taken...
So why is he doing this? I mean, why is he...
Why would you
the
think,
thing about
do you think
Obama
he might want attention?
Huh?
Do you think he likes the attention?
Well,
do you think he enjoys people talking about him and television cameras following him? And I say that's the... Probably, I mean, you're a really intelligent guy. You're a guy who obviously knows your stuff before you interview. Believe me, I've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of interviews with people and question and answer. You've done your homework, and that's a big compliment for me because I've had so many people that they're waiting for me to keep talking like I do. And, you know, they're just reading a question. They're not listening. I don't believe that really and sincerely in your heart don't have an answer for.
Well, I guess I'm curious because you've been in contact with him in recent
months.
Yeah,
no, I...
You know, I was very pleased,
and I think from the, as a producer, what they didn't, what they cut out and what they edited out was when he said, you know, I think this part was in, because I'm just experiencing it from being in the room. All the guys on my team said Richard should be fired, and Richard had should be fired because, you know, he's a liar. And Jose had steam coming out of his ears and wanted to kill him. And, you know, the producers told me the next day they had already started packing Richard Hatch's stuff up, truthfully. And he came into the room right before they come in for the final moment when they say somebody's fired. And he said, I know that I should fire Richard Hatch, but I can't wait to watch Jose Canseco strangle him. So...
Why did you do the show?
I did it for the charity that I'm about to do. In fact, when I come to Las Vegas, we're meeting the... it's a long explanation, but I'm going to do a PSA for... My mother lives in a diaper. She has severe dementia and has been there 24-hour nursing care for 5 years. She can't speak anymore, and she's disappeared. And I'm her only living relative. And what happens, the largest segment of our population are baby boomers. And I don't want my son and my daughter to have to take care of me and to see me in that state. So my charity was the, and this is how they got me to do it, because I'd never done any reality TV.
Right.
And have no intention of doing it again. But I did it because they said, you know, you can raise up to $1 million for your charity. Someone has raised over $700,000, and we're increasing all of this. And I went, $1 million? And the attention? So for, honestly... For the Alzheimer's research and prevention, and for the development of a cure, something that miraculously needs to be discovered in our culture, is that the earliest baby boomers are retiring right now. They're 65 years old. That's another 14 years of the largest segment of our population, me included in it, are going to be retiring. And my children, and if you have kids, I don't know if you do, but you're obviously not in that generation, but you do understand that somebody's going to have to be responsible for them.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're an only child and you have no other, my mother had no other brothers and sisters.
Now, this is your mom, not Shirley Jones, right?
No, this is my mother, Evelyn Wood. And it's heartbreaking, and I'm fully responsible for trying to give her a quality of life that there is none. How degrading and awful is it when you have to live in a diaper? You can't walk. You can't speak. She says one word. I'm one of two people in the world she recognizes. And it's so heartbreaking that I really think that it's going to become such a major problem in our society. The idea that I would put this on to my son and to my daughter to go, you got to take care of me. I mean, all I know is I'm going to try and bring as much awareness, and that's how they got me to do it. And
what's the name of the charity?
Yeah, the Alzheimer's Research and Prevention.
Oh, okay.
And you can go online, and they're coming to the show. The people, they're based in Los Angeles, and they're coming to the show, and we're going to discuss a plan so that I can assist them in bringing some more attention to it, and I'm going to do a PSA for them. And I think it's so important. And, you know, I've done a lot of charity work in my life, and I think it's important to be a citizen and make a contribution. I really do.
So just to sum up, you are here for two concerts, but apparently you have a plan in the works that could end up bringing you here on a much more regular basis?
I'm going to make an attempt to, I have the best thing I've ever read. I have the most, to me, the most commercially viable. It's really targeted for 18 to 24. I don't know. It's such a broad audience, but I think that's the audience that'll get it, that in the genre of movies recently, it has so many different elements to it. It's so it's such a big concept that's so obvious when you see the artwork, when you see it. It's smart, it's funny, it's scary.
And you might end up being the star. You might end up being here.
No, I definitely would. I definitely would. They want me, they sent it to me originally to do that, and you know, having been on Broadway and done that, and also having been really successful in Las Vegas, I wanted to do something, I thought it would be an effort to convince them to take it to Las Vegas and to do it there, you know, 5 nights a week. I don't want to work 8 or 10 anymore anyway. It's just too much. You have no life again.
You know, when you did The Partridge Family, you actually...
You got to stop asking me more questions.
Pardon?
We could do this all night. I have to see my wife, and I hate to do that, but we have spent a good hour.
All right.
Okay?
All right. Well,
I really do appreciate it, Steve.
Have a good day.
I hope you come to the show.
I will, sure.
Will you?
I will, yes.
Fantastic, man.
Right,
great talking to you.
Have a great day.
So, Miles, were you a fan of David Cassidy?